Ella, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great. Hello and welcome to Let's Learn Out.
People listen to this chemistry for the podcast. For the podcast. Did I say the wrong word? People listen to this podcast for the chemistry between us, and can't you tell that it's sizzling right now?
And welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn anything and everything interesting. Today we're going to be covering a science topic, answering a question, and then hopping into a miscellaneous topic. My name's Tom, and to start off the year, we're going to be talking about maybe the most meta topic we've done, which is the science and history of recorded sound.
Ooh!
What a concept, recording sound.
Oh my god.
And casting it. Into pods. A podcast, if you will.
My name is Ella, and I'm going to be asking today's question, which is, do people with prosopagnosia experience pareidolia?
Oh, dear Lord. Okay.
If I had a nickel for every time someone asked me that question. Hold on. Okay. You literally just said it. Let me try. Do people... All right, Carolyn.
Pardon, no, can't do it. My name's Caroline, and I'll be doing this week's miscellaneous topic, which is the time, story time about when I sort of met David Attenborough.
Oh, that's cool.
Delightful.
It's still sort of a sciencey topic, but it's cute. It's cute.
Yeah.
That's very sweet.
All right, and before we hop in, we have some big news.
We do.
What?
Do we want to say it at the same time?
No.
We're getting married. All of us. I feel like we've unsubtly dropped this a few times, but it is official. As you are hearing this, we have a Patreon.
Woo!
So right now the way we run the podcast, it is literally just the three of us.
I know you can't tell because of the high production quality.
Sorry, my assistant's cue cards are a little misaligned. Hey, you're fired. Get out of here. All right, backup assistant, come on in. You're hired. You're moving up. But that means that we host and distribute the show entirely ourselves. So if you want to help support the show and the things we do and maybe help us do even cooler things in the future, you can hop on the Patreon. But there's also some... nice little stuff.
Yeah, you don't just have to join just to support us. We'll give you stuff in return. Not physical stuff, but joy. No, I mean more actual stuff. We are starting a little side pod, only available through the Patreon, called Etc., which is our initials, Ella, Tom, Caroline.
Each month, we'll do more casual or silly episodes, doing things like Ask Me Anythings, playing games. I think it'd be hilarious to try and play Trivial Pursuit. If you liked our end of year Q&A episode, it'll be sort of like that vibe.
Oh, we should go. We should. Tom, you and I should go to each other's islands on Animal Crossing.
Oh!
Without me?
And Caroline can watch.
From the window in. That feed, the bonus feed, will also have our two test episodes that we did before we released the podcast. And I forgot this. Those were so early that they were before we came up with the naming convention for the episodes. So the first one is called, do you remember what the first episode is called?
No.
It's Do Love Island AI Remember Being Caterpillars?
I like it. So
also, anytime there's extra bits in the episode that don't fit, like that one time in episode 5 where we played the fanfiction game for way too long by accident,
it will go in the
etc. feed. So yeah, there's more bonuses you can check out there in detail at letslearneverythingpod.com. But the last thing, most importantly, is we do have a stretch goal at 50 patrons. We will film a generically unbranded hot sauce video interview for all the patrons.
Will we really get sued if we say hot ones?
No. It is a hot ones inspired sort of thing. I don't know about y'all. I am personally an absolute baby when it comes to hot sauce, but
me
I will
too. The biggest wuss.
I'm so excited.
Great, the three of us, it's just going to be absolute nonsense. We're just going to be in pain the entire time.
And lastly, of course, if you can't support the show through Patreon, that is totally fine. We can't say it enough that we are simply glad that you all like the show, and the show will always be free. We do this show because we like it, and we are glad that you all like it too. So yeah, thanks all.
Thank you.
Aww, nice.
So today's main topic is recorded sound. So I want to start by asking, what's y'all's familiarity with sound recording? And specifically, do you know how it works?
No.
We all do it every other week.
The voice, uh-huh. The sound makes waves.
Yeah.
And then those waves hit the microphone and...
Doing great.
Vibrate it at specific frequencies, which are then converted into electrical impulses of some form, and that
this
makes
is incredible.
See, you know, the reason why I ask at the start of the topic isn't to gauge everyone's familiarity. I do it just in case someone else can do the topic for me. Like, now, if I'm lucky and I ask, and then someone else does it, then I'm clear for the week.
I've never ever learned about how sound does recording. What
how
I don't know if any of those
things
I said were right.
So the fundamentals are perfectly correct. And I mean, like, even as someone who also records a podcast like y'all do and works with tech and plays music, there were so many moments in this where I just felt, I was like, oh, that's how it actually works. When you break it down, it's really wild, and it makes me very excited. So the first step to recording sound is to understand what sound is, and I think Ella sort of you touched on this, but so there are particles all around us. Air, if you didn't know, if you weren't aware, there's air all around us. And when you vibrate that air, that pressure causes the particles around it to also vibrate, and that vibration passes from particle to particle through the air like a wave. It's like people pushing in a mosh pit. You know, the people are the air molecules, and the sound is the pushing that travels through the pit. And this is also famously why... there's no sound in space, and in space no one can hear you scream, because there's no air particles to vibrate. There's nobody to mosh with in space.
There's no one to mosh with in space. Well,
in space, there's nobody to mosh with. So, to sum it up, sound is a vibration that moves as a wave across particles. And so, the pressure wave can be short, like a clap, that like peaks just one time, right, and moves. Or it can be a long, sustained wave, like humming a note. Like, or, you know, talking continuously over your co-host to get a good joke in. So, and if these vibrations fluctuate between 20 and... you didn't have to laugh that hard.
I'm just thinking, it's a year of self-reflection for you, and it's good for you.
So if these vibrations fluctuate between 20 and 20,000 times a second, then we can hear them. But because this sound is basically just a force, it's like a movement, that means it's something that we can measure. And that means it's also something that we can record. So I assume y'all have heard of something called the phonograph, right?
No.
So it's
this is a... I did realize we both just did this, Caroline, but this is a sound medium, so we do have to answer verbally. Yeah.
We both just shook our heads and didn't actually respond to this.
I think the silence spoke volumes.
I have heard of one, but I don't know what it is. There we go.
I've heard the word. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Likewise. You know, I think... some of you listening might have an image of a phonograph in your head, like a wax cylinder connected to like a big metal horn connected to a Thomas Edison sitting next to it always. Like that's the traditional image. And in most histories of sound recording, this is where people start. But I think a much more beautiful way to look at this story is to take one step back before the phonograph, to look at its predecessor called the phonoautograph. So the phonoautograph was made around 1853, around 20 years before the phonograph. And what it would do is this, and a phonograph functions very similarly. So you know how, like, if you press a cup against the wall, you can hear better? Because the cup basically takes all those vibrations from the opening and focuses it to the bottom of the cup. And so if you do that to the extreme by taking a big metal cone, and at the end is a really thin and sensitive parchment membrane that will vibrate a lot. And Ella, this might sound familiar to you because it was designed after how the ear canal and the eardrum work.
The human body does it best. You heard it here, folks. No technology will ever be better than what you already have inside of you.
Oh.
Love.
Oh. The best operating system is love.
Thanks, I hate it.
And so if you connect that thin paper membrane at the end of the cone to a fine point, like a needle, you can focus all of that sound onto a single point and make that point vibrate a lot. And if you focus it enough, you can actually vibrate it so much that you can actually see it. So then you take a cylinder, a tube, and you cover it in soot, and then you spin it like a rotisserie chicken, and then you run the needle along the tube, and any sound that enters the cone moves the needle and marks the cylinder, and now you can see sound. If you've ever seen recording software, I know y'all have, but like maybe on one of those like song mashup TikToks you've seen, what you'll often see is something called a waveform, and it's a drawing of sound, and it's basically the exact same thing as this. It's the same concept. And so they called this process phonoautography, or the self-writing of sound. And until I read that, I had never put that together, but a phonograph works on the same principle. And the reason it's called a phonograph is because it graphs sound. Phono meaning sound, graph meaning write.
It's literally putting it on a graph. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Right. But when you think of the word phonograph in your head, you think the Thomas Edison old device,
yeah,
right? Not something that does that.
Yeah.
Now I need to... I need to inject one quick ounce of just absolutely bizarre weirdness into this beautiful story, because science history always seems to have these bizarre stories. This isn't part of like why I think the phonoautograph is beautiful. I just couldn't not mention it. It's like the biggest left turn I've ever seen in researching something. So, you know, Alexander Graham Bell, right? He's the telephone guy.
Yeah.
The unit, the decibel, is actually named after him. So he was big into phonoautographs. This is a quote from him in the book Great Inventors and Their Inventions by Frank Bachman, and I'm just going to read it to you because you won't believe me otherwise. So this is Alexander Graham Bell. He goes, "I went to a distinguished aurist of Boston and told him I wanted to make a phonoautograph, modeling it after the human ear. He replied, 'Why don't you use a human ear itself? Taken from a dead man as a phonoautograph.' That was quite a new idea." Yeah. "And I said, I shall be very glad to do that, but where can I get a dead man's ear? Oh, he said, I will get it for you."
That's the most ominous sentence.
Why not?
The dead man's not using it.
That's a good friend. I don't know why we don't talk about... I mean, I do know why we don't talk about it, but it's just a reminder that people are weird. people are weird. And it he did, and it actually kind of worked. He, like, attached a stylus to a... It's a whole thing. Obviously... we just use, like, paper and metal. It works perfectly fine. and no one else did that. So, to come back to the point, the key thing of why I think the phonoautograph is so beautiful, and you might have noticed it in my description if you were paying close attention, because the phonoautograph was designed, right? You speak into the cone, it vibrates the membrane, and then it draws the sound, right? So the phonoautograph was designed to record sound, but not to play it back.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the inventor of the phonoautograph, Edouard Leon Scott, described this process as words that wrote themselves. That was where his mindset was. Yes, Ella?
So I just put my hand up for those on the... I mean, you could play them back, because if it's... Look, just bear with me, okay? It's writing, uh-huh. It's writing them down, so you've got the waveforms. So couldn't you just be like... You know, you read them back.
Like sheet music. Ella is miming holding sheet music.
Could you then read the sound, basically, is what you're saying.
So that was their idea. They really wanted to be able to... analyze like what speech was, like saying words, singing pitches, like that. And for the longest time, it was for scientific analysis of looking at it. According to auditory historian David Giovanni, quote, "The idea of somehow putting these signals back into the air never occurred to Scott."
Why would you want to? You have them on the paper now. Who cares?
Well, but I find it so beautiful that there are recordings, like, and there's a question, right? Like, is it even, this is like a philosophical question. It's like, is it even a recording if you can't play it back?
It's recorded,
yes, right?
But does that make it a recording?
So during this 20-year period of time between the phonoautograph and the phonograph, there are recordings that people made that couldn't be played back. And I just think that's...
I love the idea that somebody was just, like, so excited that they could record their own voice.
Yeah, yeah.
For, like, for no reason. Yeah.
I do, yeah, I know. That's obviously, yeah, that's cool.
And it's sort of poetic. It's like inventing the camera and then 20 years later being like, oh, I could have developed these photos, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So eventually, 20 years later, in 1877, the phonograph is invented, and that is able to both... So what it does is it etches the recordings into a groove in a tube made of tinfoil or wax at the time. And then afterwards, you put that stylus, the needle, back into the groove and move it along, and it can play the sound back. Basically... the grooves cause the same vibrations as those that created it. It's really, like, beautiful, honestly, how simple this concept is. It's like, you make a vibration, you etch it, and then you play it back. It's really nuts. Also, right, so this one is called the phonograph, and the invention before is called the phonoautograph. Part of me wonders, like, did they have, like, a Facebook-style conversation that Edison was like, drop the auto, just phonograph. It's cooler. You know what's cooler than a soot-covered tube? A tinfoil-covered tube. But
did you write that joke down, Tom?
But regardless, these were the first recordings. What's interesting is that The first phonograph records were made in tinfoil. They would wrap it around the cylinder, and it literally looks like crumpled tinfoil that you would use to cover a pie.
Mm.
You can look it up. They have some at the Smithsonian. If you look online on YouTube, people have recordings of Edison's first thing he said into a phonograph, which is, "Mary Had a Little Lamb," and I can play it for you right now.
Oh, amazing!
Mary had a little lamb, it squeaked white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
When did he record that?
Well, I have to say, as quickly as I can, if you have ever seen this online claiming that this is Edison's first recording, it's actually a lie.
Oh.
No!
So, what you just heard was actually recorded in 1927 on the 50th anniversary of the phonograph. So, 50 years later, which is why it sounds so good.
Uh-huh.
And the full quote, it's basically a celebration of the phonograph and Edison's talking. And the full quote that most people clip when they post it online and claim this is the first recording is, he goes, "The first words I ever spoke in the original phonograph, a little piece of practical poetry," and then he says it. So he did allegedly say that, but I'll play you the full clip right here so you can hear it.
"The first words I spoke in the original phonograph, a little piece of practical poetry. Mary had a little lamb, it squeaked white as snow."
There we go.
I was thinking he sounds really old in that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, he must have been super old.
That's another great point, yeah. So the reason why this is the recording that we have is because tinfoil tubes were so fragile.
Yeah.
Of course.
They could only be played back a few times before they just completely fell apart.
Oh, wow.
Which is another really, like, existential concept moment, right? Like, imagine a book that you can only read 5 times before it falls apart.
Well, that's terrifying.
Like, what kind of a recording is that even? It almost doesn't feel like a recording if it doesn't still exist, right? And obviously, it's not. It did happen, but I think it speaks to our nature of our expectations of what recordings are and how badly we want these recordings to exist that we can't accept that these recordings are gone. And we tell ourselves this lie. That is off by 50 years.
Yeah.
But we do have some records. So these are actually, no more tricks. These are actually some of the earliest recordings we have. This one dates back to 1881. Okay. I love this one.
Sounds like a pigeon.
It does.
Is it someone pretending to be a pigeon?
So let me read you how the Smithsonian transcribes this. It goes, tone. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 2 more tones. I think this is amazing because this one in particular is like if you gave a kid a voice recorder, like this is the first thing they do. And I think it's very like, it's like, whoa, ooh, 1, 2, 3. Like it's very... It speaks to something in us that this is one of our earliest recordings. But it's also, it's just like amazing because it's the human voice recorded, right? And like, it's very easy to take that for granted because that's what you're listening to right now. But like, it's wild. And around this time, this is the first time it's happening ever in history. So we're going to play a little game and then I'm going to ask you a question that doesn't have an answer. Does that sound okay?
I'm down. Yeah.
So the game is, did this happen before or after the concept of recorded audio in 1877?
Oh, God, okay.
Humans landing on the moon. Was this before or after?
After.
It was in 1969, which is within a human lifespan of that, which is wild.
Oh, shit, I didn't know. Yeah, when you put it in that kind of context, that's...
So... did this happen before or after the concept of recorded audio? Women being allowed to vote in the United States.
After. That was the 20s, 1920s?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. Good. Hey, look at you. Yes, that happened. Recorded audio happened before women could vote in the United States.
That doesn't surprise me that much.
It's funny.
The telephone.
After.
No.
Well, but...
wait, what?
Happened a year before.
Oh, How strange.
I know, isn't it? But the concept of transmitting audio...
was easier than recording it. That's,
oh, exactly.
That actually does make make a lot of sense. Because they had to get to the recording part, they had to understand how sound worked generally, right? So, yeah.
But it speaks to our biases that, like, we... because now recording sound is much easier than transmitting it, right? And so... It's very interesting to think about that. Last one is the creation of the Constitution of the United States.
Before.
Well, then how did they record Hamilton? So regardless, I'm always surprised how long it took us to record sound, especially given how, like I was saying, like it's the explanation is so intuitive, right? And especially given how ubiquitous visual art is and written language, like those happened really early on. And so the question that doesn't have an answer is, why did it take us so long to record sound?
Oh, that's such a good question.
Well, when did we record images first? You know, photographs?
That is a good question. I'll look that up.
Because I reckon it wasn't that much earlier than sound. Yeah. It was before, certainly, but not that much earlier.
I also wonder, like, what other technologies we had at the time. And generally what our, like, understanding of things like like the human body were at the time.
That's a good point. If this understanding of sound came from understanding of the ear,
yeah,
we had such poor understanding of the human body up until probably the late 1800s, and even then it wasn't.
That's a great point.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I had not considered that. That's a great point. It's estimated around the first permanent photograph, a contact exposed copy of an engraving, was made in 1822. So that was earlier.
So not even that, but not even that much earlier, 50 years earlier.
Right.
So,
But I feel like, and you know, I could be wrong. I feel like the process of photography is much more involved than, you know, making vibrations, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. There is no answer to this.
That's a good point.
No, but I think the thing about photography is that a lot of that understanding is, I think that like very early kind of understanding of photography is about just images being exposed onto something, not even like proper photography. Like,
oh, that's a good point.
With like a pinhole, right? That's
a
great
point. Mm-hmm. So the basics came almost by accident, mm-hmm. in a way, or through very basic understanding, and then you could grow on that. Whereas this, it sounds to me like what you're saying is the basics of recording sound came from a very intricate human and anatomical thing.
Yeah.
And also like a very deliberate process to try and figure out how to do this thing.
Yeah.
Rather than like,
they went really into the hard stuff immediately.
Yeah. Whereas like the process of photographs seems to have almost happened like accidentally.
One other thing I totally forgot about, and I literally didn't realize until we were having this discussion, is that we're a very visual species,
mm-hmm.
and sound is invisible.
That's a really good point. Yeah,
that's a very good point.
You know, I think there's also probably sociological answers to this also. Like, I feel like spoken tradition is a very proximal thing. And if we, you know, before we were sending messages far, maybe there's a thing to be said that like you just made sounds and you told stories with the people who were near to you. But then maybe as cities grow, you know, if you have theories, please let us know in the Discord. I just think it's a genuinely really interesting question, mm-hmm. because of how ubiquitous it is now, right?
It is.
So yeah.
Is there something to be said about like how we've had paintings for such a long time?
Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And just like the thought of like we could have this be easier, whereas there was no concept of sound being recorded. So nobody probably ever even thought about doing it.
Although,
but then that's like sheet music.
Oh, that's
right?
A good point.
Like that existed.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, sheet music. Yeah,
that's such a good point. Yeah.
And in a way, we'll get into this a bit later. But in a way, I don't know if I fully believe this, but sheet music is kind of like digital audio in a sense. We'll get into that. But regardless, once we have the phonograph, the technology gets improved. And experimented on. They tried a bunch of different mediums like rubber, beeswax, glass, tinfoil, brass. Records were made in shellac for a while, and then eventually vinyl, polyvinyl chloride. And what's interesting is that this format of literally just etching sound into things sticks around for a long time. I didn't know this. The phonograph, the gramophone, and the record player are all basically the same thing, to the point where if you search on Wikipedia, they all link to the same page.
Oh, wow.
I feel like that makes a lot of sense to me, because mm-hmm. What you're describing is those images with the giant funnel. That is the early record players look like, right? They have that. They had the pin linked to the big, like shell-shaped sound thing, right? So that makes a lot of sense.
I just think like, to the point, they're literally sections of the same Wikipedia page. I had never intuited that, because all they do is just focus vibrations into a medium and then play them back.
Mm.
Even as we get into electrical amplifiers and motorized cabinets, right, the technology at its core is still the same. You're just like augmenting it on the input and output side, right? And even with magnetic tape, as we get to reels and cassettes, it's just turning physical vibration of a sound into an electromagnetic signal. So instead of drawing a line up and down, you're making a tape more and less magnetic, right? It's still mapping one-to-one, basically, which is wild.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong. The quality improves tremendously for music recordings.
Yeah.
Like, the oldest record that I have sounds amazing. Do you guys want to guess the oldest? Also, if it wasn't clear from who I am as a person, I have records. I'm bad. I am that person.
Is it Queen?
I do have some, but I have a few that are older.
I don't know. I couldn't.
I'm so excited to find out.
Is it?
Do you want to guess the year?
Oh. Okay. Ooh. It's 1973.
Carolyn?
I'm gonna go a bit earlier than that. I'm gonna go 1968.
So it's a Frank Sinatra album. It's Come Fly With Me, and it is from 1958.
Wow.
I got it for $1.
What
it
the is fuck?
It's beat up, but it sounds amazing, right? If you put it on and sit and think, you cannot tell it's unless you're really focusing that it's a record versus it's to the point where I would play it for y'all, but it is good enough that I think it'll be copyright stricken is how good it is, right? And sometimes if you just like sit down and like put the needle on, you're like, this is magic.
Yeah, it is magic. It's strange that like that's much more, I think, like easily explainable than what you're now going to explain about like future sound recording.
Yeah, yeah.
And I still will perceive like vinyl as much more magic.
Totally.
Just the whole experience of it. Yeah,
it's about that physical, like what we can see, mm-hmm. thing, right? Oh, I see the needle and it touches the thing and then a sound? Wow!
Once again, humans being very visual species.
No, yeah, and I think it's true. And I think, you know, this is a cool trick you can do if you know anyone that has a record player. You can obviously play a record plugged into the stereo system, but if you turn off the stereo system and just have the record spinning with the needle, and you put your ear right next to the needle, you can hear it.
Oh,
you can hear the record.
Oh. Because of like very tiny vibrations.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you can, if you make a cone out of paper and you take a needle and you tape it to the end and you run it across the grooves of a record, you can hear it. You shouldn't, because it'll ruin the record. But you can, because that's sort of like the magic of analog, is that it is one. You can't do that with an MP3 file, obviously. Is that it's it.
You can't tell me what to do.
I can't remember what YouTuber it was. Maybe it was William Osman, who tried to record like a record but onto cardboard, I think it was.
Yeah, I mean,
using the same thing.
That makes sense.
And it worked. It sounded terrible, but he literally just used the vibrations and it worked. I thought it was really cool.
So analog recording is amazing. It's wild, and it continues to this day. People still get vinyl records. So there finally comes a big fundamental change to how we record audio, and that's digital recording. So I just love this. I found this. This is a quote about digital recordings from record engineer Jerry Bruck. Basically, when they were first introducing digital recorders, they would go to regular recording sessions and be like, hey, can we also record this digitally? Just to see how it goes, because they're still experimenting with the technology. And so this is a quote. He goes, I knew that we were dealing with something different when Tom called me on the intercom to say he had noted a hum on our feed. Surprised? I turned up our monitor, which is a speaker, but heard nothing amiss. I asked him what level he thought it was at. He checked and called back. It's about 80 decibels down, which was so quiet that they couldn't hear it on the analog medium because it got buried beneath the background noise of the tape. Like, that was just the acceptable noise level that they were just like, oh, that's like the noise floor. You can't, that's just acceptable background noise.
Right.
And so aside from making recordings sound better, you know, you could take that disc and make it more compact. Turn it into a compact disc or a CD, if you will.
Hey.
Oh.
But the really fundamental change doesn't have to do with the quality of the recording or the size. It's what you can do with it. So this is one of my favorite concepts, the difference between analog and digital. So I need to ask, do you know what the difference is when someone says a recording is analog versus digital?
No. Physical versus in
You're the cooler if you like analog is the answer.
Yeah. One is on my computer and one is not.
One is electrical and one is not.
Actually, the electrical component isn't a requirement, because if you record with an electrical microphone, it can still be entirely analog. It's so we'll get into it, but Digital means able to convert to discrete digits, whereas analog recording is continuous. It's just one long line. So I'm going to draw a waveform in Sharpie on a piece of paper, right? Pretending I'm using a phono autograph to do this. Mm-hmm. And I've drawn it, and it's beautiful, and it's analog. But how would I send it to you, right? So an analog way would be if I could like press it against another sheet of paper while the ink is still wet so that it rubs off and then I can mail it to you. But that transference is always imperfect, right? If I send the first one to Ella, it would probably look way better than the second imprint I make to Carolyn. So another thing I can do is send you precise instructions on how to make it yourself. So I could say, draw a line that starts at zero, then go to 0.05 millimeters, then go to 0.052 millimeters, then go down to 0.02 millimeters. Basically, I would send you a million tiny measurements, right? A million tiny digits.
Yeah.
And then if you understand how to decode those instructions, you can recreate the waveform. And that's what digital is. And this is wild. How many little numbers do you think the last episode of our podcast was?
Oh my God, our podcast is so long.
the last episode was 1 hour, 16 minutes, and 36 seconds.
A billion.
500 billion.
So it is actually a little bit less than that. So it's sampled at 44.1 kilohertz. So 44,100 times per second is how many numbers.
Oh, is that what kilohertz means?
Yeah, exactly. So that's 202,683,600 digits, basically instructions to recreate the beautiful sounds of our voices.
Wow. So it's basically the difference between doing like a beautiful oil painting yourself and like connect the dots. Like that's it.
Wow, kind of. Wait. Yes.
No, but if the connect the dots was so precise that you couldn't even move like a micrometer before.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that obviously that's too many numbers for a person to try to turn back into waveform, but it's a piece of cake for a computer, because that's what computers are excellent at doing, is like lots of digital tasks with numbers.
There's something really dehumanizing about hearing this. Like, the people listening to this podcast right now aren't really hearing us. They're hearing like a
computer reconstructed version of us.
Yes, yeah. A very, very precise computer reconstruction of our voice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna. I agree. I agree. It's a little wonky. If it makes you feel better, and this is sort of where the line between digital and analog blurs in a really interesting way, and why I think this concept is so interesting. Like, we are making vibrations into a microphone. It gets stored and then recreated in other people's ears. Like, we are that is still a physical thing that does happen.
I guess, yeah, that makes it feel better, because our brain processing, like our auditory neurons processing the vibrations is actually in a way the thing the computer is doing,
right? And it's in a way, everything digital is analog and everything analog is digital. It gets messy, but the other great thing is that because it's a set of instructions, if I send these instructions to Ella and I send it to Carolyn, it will be the exact same thing, because it's discrete instructions. And so, first of all, you can optimize it. So let's say in our podcast, I tell a bad joke and there's like 5 seconds of silence. The digits in the recording.
And just to be clear, there always is.
I just edit it out every time.
Always, always
the recording, the digits are going to be like 0000000000000. So instead of listing each one out, a computer can just say, that's 1,000 zeros. And then that saves a ton of space. Because instead of sorting every single one, you just say 1,000 zeros. There's a ton of other awesome, really fascinating ways that engineers have been able to compress this information.
Mm. Is that what a when you compress an audio file, is that what it's doing? Like using those tricks to,
yes,
like those zeros and
So there's lossy compression, which basically means that there are little corners that are cut that you're okay with getting away with, but then the audio will degrade slightly. And then mm-hmm. there's lossless compression, which does these tricks so that by the end, it's identical.
Oh, okay. Very interesting.
But in the storage of it, it's smaller. The other great thing is that unlike tinfoil audio recordings, you can keep playing and making copies of these instructions without it changing.
Of course.
Everybody's copy of this episode of the podcast is identical.
Except yours, Janet.
We love you, Janet. You're our number one fan.
Janet, if you're listening, come and say hi in the Discord server. We want to know.
If you're hearing this and you're not Janet, you got the wrong episode.
This is not for you. Janet, let us know, please.
Thanks, Janet. Hey, Janet, thanks.
We love you. We love you, Janet.
So everyone, except for Janet, everyone's copy of the episode is identical. Which is amazing. Like that, again, another thing we can't take for granted is like, yeah. And so you can store this digital information on paper or on a hard drive, or you can send it across the internet to someone. So, right, imagine being able to listen to audio without having to get a physical disc, right? You could say, I don't know, cast it directly into someone's pod. You could podcast it. And that means you don't have to be a celebrity who can afford to print physical media. You can just record it and send it.
Is that, you know how people, adults, complain that like, oh, there's some, everyone's making music now. It's blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it's because people couldn't afford to make music before, basically.
Totally. Obviously, there are problems with the way streaming media happens, but, you know, people talk about, like, rock stars making more money back then, and it's like, yeah, because there were, like, a handful of them, right? There were a finite...
They didn't have to fight for your patronage.
Right. And yeah, exactly. And not even just, like, performing, but recording at all, right? Like, not even, like, being a person who, like, performs at these big venues, but even being able to, like, send music that you make to someone else. Like, that simple action.
Like us having this amazing quality podcast. Which you can support through Patreon.
I should have made that the topic. Is patronage, the concept of patronage. So, digital audio is amazing. It's changed our world in like more ways than we can even say. But there's one last amazing thing that it can do. So do you remember that old tinfoil recording that I played earlier with the guy going, ooh, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the earliest recordings ever. I can play it again real quick just so you can hear it. And because I love it, I will always do the excuse to play it. Now, how did I play that for you?
Digitally.
That's true, but how did we record it digitally?
I assume someone recorded it off of an analog recording. Like, they played it out loud and then recorded it, like, on their phones.
So that is possible, but by the time we have digital recordings, especially these early, extremely fragile ones...
Oh, you had to get it. You had to convert it.
Before
they disintegrated.
Right. But even active playing it now is like too risky almost, right? Because it's like, well, you can ruin it in that one. So
did someone photograph it?
Yes.
And then use that. There you go.
Exactly.
Took the waveforms or whatever and converted them.
So in the early 2000s, scientists at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory developed a process through which they can take a picture of a tinfoil sheet and then turn those waveforms into digital audio instructions and then recreate the audio.
What year did you say they did this? Sorry?
Sometime in the early 2000s.
Oh, that's quite early. I'm surprised it's that far long ago because I assume it's like some kind of algorithm that recognizes like loads and loads of points, right?
Yeah.
So, and I thought that would have...
I mean, I'm sure it's only been able to improve now that we have...
of course, yeah.
But now that we can turn drawings back into audio... This means, do you remember the phonoautograph drawings that I mentioned earlier?
We can make them noisy again.
Exactly. In 2008, those same scientists were able to photograph those drawings that were never planned to be heard.
Amazing. That is amazing.
They were never intended to be heard. And turn it back into sound.
I hope it's got the people's, like...
Oh my god, I hope they're saying some real dirty stuff.
Yeah.
They're, like, really getting it, they're laying it out. Mm-hmm, I fucking hate you, Margaret.
Mm-hmm. Oh, did you see that Janet was riding that big bicycle with the single wheel, the big wheel, whatever
it's called.
Penny farthing. Did you see Janet's new penny farthing? I can't believe. So, this audio I'm about to play is... from April of 1860, and it is believed to be the earliest sound recording. So, obviously, it's a bit messy.
Do we know who it is?
So, it's believed to be Edward Leon Scott himself, who invented the phonautograph, singing the French children's folk song, Au Clair de la Lune. And I just want to say how beautiful it is that Edison's first recording was Mary Had a Little Lamb, and then 150 years later, we're able to recreate an even older recording, and it's also... a children's song, right? There's something sweet that when we are given this chance to make a record, that's what we reach for, right? It's nuts.
It's either that or just a random person going, ooh, which is also delightful.
Anyway, I think in a way we've become really inundated with recorded audio, but when you really realize like what's going on, it's impossible not to feel like it's magic. That's it.
Oh, that was really
amazing.
Lovely.
I can't believe you called out my pre-written joke. It's so funny. It read like that. It totally did.
Today's question, the question I came up with because I was really genuinely interested to find out. Normally when I bring these questions to you guys, I already know the answer and I feel, you know, flesh it out. I did not know the answer going into this, which was exciting for me. And the question
it's
is...
fun.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, hold on, wait. I'm sorry. Can me and Carolyn try to recall it real quick?
Oh, yeah, okay. Try and recall the question.
Do people with pareidolia experience glossolalia?
It was another sound.
You got pareidolia, but it's it was.
Wait, did I really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Do
And it's not. I don't know what that second thing is you said, but I like it.
I believe glossolalia is speaking in tongues.
I want to say whenever I say pareidolia, I want to say pareidolalia because of the way. So I wondered why. Yeah. Maybe that's why. No, did you any expansions on that?
Pharagolia.
Great. Excellent.
Nailed it.
The question is, do people with prosopagnosia experience pareidolia? And obviously...
Prosopagnosia.
I had this feeling that you guys would know what each of those words mean. I didn't think you'd know both of them meant... that both of you would know what both of them meant, but I thought that one of you would each know one of the words, and there's a kind of a reason for that.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think I'm familiar with pareidolia.
I think you might be too, Tom, because it seems like something you would know. And if I say apophenia,
yes,
does that mean anything more to you?
Yeah. What it's apophenia is it's a thing we've mentioned a handful of times on the podcast. It's finding patterns in things because we are very pattern seeking animals, and I believe
pareidolia
is specifically seeing faces in things.
That's face pareidolia. Pareidolia is just seeing a meaningful image in a random visual pattern. So like seeing an image in a cloud.
Got it. Okay.
But I did kind of trick you, because the question really should be, do people with prosopagnosia experience face pareidolia? Because you're right, face pareidolia is seeing faces in random objects or patterns.
Can I say, it's so fun each time you repeat that question, my brain being like, I got 50% of that this time.
So if I'm asking that question, what could prosopagnosia be?
Is it face blindness?
It is face blindness.
Oh.
Hey.
Hold on. Okay. You could have gotten off your high horse and said, do people with face blindness see faces and things?
But prosopagnosia is the actual name. I learned about it during my undergrad. So it means you can't recognize people's faces. It's estimated that as many as 1 in 50 people are born with prosopagnosia, 2% of the population.
Wow.
But obviously there's different severities, it's a spectrum.
Sure, sure.
I saw a really interesting TikTok, and it was somebody who had face blindness, and they said that the pandemic has made it easier because people started using reusable face masks. And they would recognize the face mask rather than recognizing the person. Yeah.
Well, that's exactly it.
That's amazing.
Some people. One of the ways people with prosopagnosia counteract it is by memorizing features like hair.
Yeah.
Wow.
And what I was about to say is it's a spectrum. So some people can just not distinguish between similar looking people. Some people might experience it slightly to an extent. They don't even realize, seeing one celebrity as another celebrity. But some people have it to the severity where they couldn't recognize their own mother.
Oh my goodness.
Wow. Unless they heard their voice or saw a distinctive feature. It can affect seeing someone's identity, but also their gender and their emotional expressions. So those are the kind of things that, the prosopagnosia can affect.
Could you say that phrase one more time? I'm so sorry. I want to fully get it in my brain.
Prosopagnosia.
Prosopagnosia.
It means, I got the actual meaning up because I was interested, and it's...
It means to write sound.
The Greek prosopon, meaning face, and the word agnosia, meaning non-knowledge.
Face non-knowledge.
What a powerful word. Prosoagnosia?
Prosopagnosia.
Prosopagnosia. Okay.
And also, this is really interesting. People with prosopagnosia often find it hard to distinguish between animals of the same species.
Whoa.
And cars.
Cars do have faces.
I think before we get to the answering the question, do people with prosopagnosia experience pareidolia? We might need to think about how facial recognition and processing in the brain works.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah,
yes.
Totally.
Yay.
Okay.
I love this.
How do you know anything about this?
Aren't there a few different theories on how we process faces?
There certainly are, but there are definitely some solid things we understand.
Yeah.
And then there are things outside of that which we are not sure about. Or we're not sure about necessarily the things we do understand, how much they play into
Right.
the facial recognition. I'm going down one specific track, but I will put a disclaimer that it's not necessarily the only way or the main way, but it's something that people are very interested in and focused on right now in research.
A good note. Yes.
Yeah.
Any? Do you have any? No, you seem to have an idea, Caroline.
I learnt a very small amount about facial recognition back when I was 17 in psychology.
Bring that back.
Honestly, at the time, it was just the idea of looking at it from a holistic idea. So you have to look at everything rather than the idea of looking at individual features and using those to recognize it. Yeah,
that's a very good point. That's a really good point. The idea of seeing a face as a whole thing. This is, as I said, this is one idea of how we recognize faces, but it is probably, it's definitely part of how we recognize faces. It just depends on who you talk to, how important this part is. But faces are so important to the human experience that the brain has an area solely devoted to the task of facial recognition.
Wow.
It lights up. When you see a face, this part of the brain lights up. It's called the fusiform gyrus.
Wow.
Can you say that again?
The fusiform gyrus.
And again?
Fusiform gyrus.
You say it 5 times quickly?
Fusiform gyrus, fusiform gyrus, fusiform gyrus, fusiform gyrus, fusiform gyrus. Absolutely.
Oh my god.
It's
prosopagnosia pareidolia. Prosopagnosia pareidolia.
Yes!
Prosopagnosia pareidolia. New York.
Well done. It's specifically a region. So this part of the brain is, it's hard to audibly describe this, but I would say it's at a lobe at the bottom of the brain, near the brain stem. I'm pointing to the bit of my head that attaches to my neck.
Yeah, like if you had a head migraine in a commercial, you might reach back there, kind of a thing.
Oh yeah, that's actually a very good point. But, yeah, no. Oh, that works. So it's specifically a region in that gyrus called the fusiform face area. So we've known about this since the late 90s. MRI studies show that this area of the brain lights up in scans when people look at faces. And usually only faces, not bodies.
Ah.
Wow.
So when macaques are shown pictures of, like, headless bodies, the neurons don't light up. Yeah, but when the body has a head, the neurons light up. So it's not about, like, a being. It is about specifically a face.
Mm-hmm.
That's really...
That's so interesting.
Even though the monkeys could still recognize things from bodies, wasn't using that part of its brain as mm-hmm. recognition. So for a long time, for a couple of decades, this evidence was only correlation rather than causation.
Right, right. That's a great point, yeah.
But back in 2012, we had like first very strong evidence that this area of the brain was used in facial recognition. I just saw this in an article. I thought it was really interesting.
This is so recent that like a psych textbook when I went to high school wouldn't have this.
Yeah, absolutely wouldn't have had it. It's such a good point. So there's this guy called Ron Blackwell, an engineer from Santa Clara, if anyone cares. He went to Stanford University to seek treatment for his very severe epilepsy. And they placed electrodes all over his head where they thought the seizures mm-hmm. might originate and tried to trigger them in safe conditions. But when a signal was sent through one specific electrode, Ron Blackwell said to the researchers, "You just turned into somebody else. Your whole face just metamorphosed.
Oh, I hate that.
How crazy is that?
I hate that and also really want to experience it, you know?
Yeah, it sounds wild.
Yeah.
So as soon as this...
good on him for being able to verbalize that, because I would have just gone... I would have gone, ooh.
Well, when the stimulation stopped, the faces just went back to what they were before.
Oh,
and this
my
time was like
God.
The first real confirmation. And they saw, that the area of the electrode stimulated was the fusiform gyrus, the fusiform face area, and it kind of gave that first confirmation.
What did we just poke? What was that?
I think they put the electrode where they thought the fusiform gyrus was, so they had an idea, but they reconfirmed it through imagery.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
I actually saw a paper called The Neurons That Mistook a Hat for a Face. So this area, the fusiform...
What's the original call? The man who mistook his wife for a face?
Yes,
for a,
oh, the wap.
For a face.
For a hat. Yeah. This was from 2020.
Oh, wow.
And they found, it was in macaques again, they found that if they will respond to faceless bodies if there is context that a face should be there.
Oh.
Whoa.
So if the neurons, if the body was positioned in such a way that it implied the presence of a face... Or the face was occluded in some way, like with that.
Yeah. Like the René Magritte painting with the apple in front of the head.
Yeah, then the fusiform gyrus was more likely to light up or would have a stronger reaction as if there was a face there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, that's so interesting.
So context seems to be also key for facial recognition.
Wow.
Which actually might be important in understanding this question.
Oh,
don't say anything.
Oh, gosh.
My question is, so obviously this part of our brain lights up if it's just a face without a body as well?
Yes.
Just to clarify that.
Yeah, if it's just a face. And in fact, that's when it has the strongest recognition.
When it's strongest, okay.
But if there is the implication of a face, it will also sometimes. Or rather, it has a weaker signal, but it's still mm-hmm. there.
I know this is a very me thing to say, but like this feels like I'm debugging a problem. And I'm like, where does one region, like, is one higher order than the other? Do they connect to the same? I'm fascinated by this. Please go on.
Yeah, I mean, it's so complicated. I think, you know, I should, you know, definitely disclaimer this by saying I'm not a neuroscientist. And neuroscience and this kind of understanding of circuitry and systems is so complicated.
Of course.
And I will also add this, attributing such a large role in face perception to the fusiform face area alone is a bit of an oversimplification, and it likely involves a network of brain regions that extend beyond this to other parts, including the occipital and temporal lobes. And we will see a bit more of this, but now we talk about, I want to ask you guys, if this is how facial recognition works, what is happening in prosopagnosia?
That's the question.
I guess that part of the brain's just... not doing the thing it's supposed to be doing.
It's on vacation.
Either not lighting up or not, like, strong enough, basically.
That's a good, yeah. It's not reacting, it's not the, you know, yeah. Those neurons aren't responding is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could be, maybe this is a silly thing, but possibly like a plasticity issue where just like that region was just used for some other kind of thing.
Ah. And that's
thinking about how the brain, right? Because it's not like that part, like it's like a city at night and like that region has like a power outage, you know? I doubt it. I mean, I could be wrong, but.
It's interesting you say that because, so you can be born with prosopagnosia or you can acquire it.
Oh.
And the different ways you've just suggested that actually kind of fall into the, I think, what I understand of it, the different types. So with acquired prosopagnosia, it's from damage,
mm-hmm.
so lesions in that area. So actually it just cannot react anymore. Neurons in the area cannot react because they are damaged or they're not there. So that's,
oh, wow.
But if you're born with it, it seems to be a lot of different ways, but mm-hmm. some of the research suggests that there's deficient white matter tracks connecting this region to other regions of the brain.
Oh, it's a connection.
So even if it is, because there is a case study of an individual who had very severe prosopagnosia, but they had an intact and functional fusiform facial area.
The idea
potentially is that maybe they're not sending signals to the other parts of the brain that they mm-hmm. should be. Something developmentally went wrong. But it could...
Brain is so complicated.
Yeah, it's incredibly complicated. But if we also look at the fusiform facial area in terms of pareidolia, we see lots of studies that say that looking at real faces and face pareidolia images, it causes the activation in the same part of the brain, in the fusiform face area, as well as a very strong activation in the prefrontal cortex.
Mm-hmm.
And in another study, the fusiform facial area shows a specific response when participants are shown images of face illusionary images as opposed to just static or like letter illusionary images. So there you do get that same light up in the same way where you see when you see a real face.
Right. Like my understanding of what pareidolia is it would be an overactive fusiform.
Well, that's a really good point. And we will come back around to that because I'm going to ask you now to answer the question. Can people, with all of this context, do people with prosopagnosia experience pareidolia?
My guess, I think, stays this. I think my guess is no. Yeah, because, yeah, like I said, it would, right? Like, if I'm thinking about this in very simplified logical terms, the fusiform gyrus causes you to recognize faces. And that's probably what's responsible for you seeing faces and things. And so if it's not able to connect or it's damaged, then you would not have this overactive phenomena because you wouldn't have it at a standard level to begin with, I suppose.
That's as good a theory as any.
I want to go the other way.
Okay, go on.
Interesting. And say maybe your brain tries to overcompensate in looking for faces.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And then sees faces everywhere.
I think that's very interesting because, like, evolutionary, the reason we have, facial recognition is such an important part of evolution in terms of, like, understanding other of our species' emotional expression, right? So I think that's a very interesting idea.
Tell us the answer.
But anyway, the answer is...
Yeah, what were we expecting? It's science.
The answer is maybe, probably. When I asked myself this question, I assumed that research would have been done on it. So I didn't even look for the answer before I started looking for all of the details about the other stuff. Because I was like, of course someone will have studied this. Because if I've had this question, someone who does like neuroscience will have had this question.
Sounds like someone's on their way to making a Wikipedia page.
Anyway, turns out hasn't been a lot of research on this.
Wow.
If I basically found one study from 2021.
Wow. What?
Oh, wow.
No way.
First, I'll tell you that this is obviously circumstantial, but I went on the prosopagnosia subreddit.
Of course.
And according to the people there who have prosopagnosia, they do experience pareidolia.
Oh.
They're saying they experience it. I've got some quotes here from user Irma Fluff. Yes, face blindness doesn't mean that you can't see there is a face. You certainly know you're looking at a face. Mo523 says, yeah, faces look like faces to me, not a random assembly of shapes. My brain just doesn't naturally combine the shapes that are unique into something I can remember to recognize that face again.
So it's basically like, yes, I see face, but I couldn't, like, if somebody else saw a bunch of leaves that look like Barack Obama, they wouldn't be able to know it was Barack Obama.
Yeah, you wouldn't necessarily know it was Jesus on a piece of toast.
Yes, right. Yeah. But you're still seeing a face. Yeah.
That's a perfect, yeah. It's also like, I can't tell cars apart, brands of cars apart, but I know it's a car.
Yes,
right?
I think that's... actually, it was in this subreddit that I saw someone mentioning that they always lose their car and it's because of the, in like a parking lot, because of their prosopagnosia, because they can't tell them apart. And then I found later on saying that for some reason, people with prosopagnosia don't recognize cars.
So that's a pretty spot on metaphor then.
But yeah.
Ella, can I just say, I can't believe you dug through Reddit research. I'm amazed.
This is incredible. I will obviously, again, another disclaimer. This is not actual research. It's
anecdotal. But it's
real people's, real experiences.
Grain of salt, but yeah, it's real.
But we can't know what severity of prosopagnosia they have. Mm-hmm. I suspect that like people with very severe prosopagnosia might find it harder to... some people in that subreddit did say that they will only see it if someone points it out to them. Like, you would see, in a two window shaped like eyes and a door shaped like a mouth immediately, and they would not see it unless you went, that's what that is. All connects into this idea, this kind of brain area. But how? Who knows? I don't know, certainly. I will say, so this study in May 2021, they weren't investigating prosopagnosia and pareidolia. They were investigating how mental imagery and pareidolia are linked. So they only considered prosopagnosia in the study as a confounding variable. So they just took it into account. A lot of people do have it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like a single offhanded sentence in the like kind of scheme of the whole study that says that pareidolia, there was no evidence that it had a relationship with prosopagnosia, basically. That was it. There was a single line, and well, I don't know what to do with this information.
I swear they do that for fun, just to it's like a little, like, it's like an Avengers teaser at the end, post-credits thing. This happens all the time, where just like the most wild single sentence will be dropped, and it'll just be like, please extrapolate.
Yeah, it seemed like there should be so much more depth to that, but it's not what they were looking at, because...
Wow, yeah.
This study actually found a strong correlation between having more vivid mental imagery, so more vivid like imagination or the ability to do that, than the ability to recognize face-like patterns from white noise. So, after all my research, I realized that I was asking the wrong question. And my new question to you is, do people with aphantasia experience pareidolia?
Wow.
Caroline,
shit.
I think you might be able to help me here.
So I do.
What a turn. I'm okay. Wow.
So Caroline, do you want to explain what aphantasia is and why you know what that is?
It's basically...
Wait, I don't know. Wait, please go on.
This is something that I have, where basically you have no images in your brain.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So I have basically... Like, if you told me to imagine an apple, there would be no image there. There's a great little graph somewhere that maybe we'll put in the Discord server. But yeah, there's just head empty.
So if you closed your eyes... I want to ask you now. I'm turning the whole thing around. I'm asking... if you were to close your eyes now and I asked you to picture my face, could you do that?
I could not.
So do you think, because imagining faces is part of the facial recognition... visual perception thing. It's all it's very specific, right? But part of people with prosopagnosia is that because they don't remember, like... Because they don't have facial recognition, they can't go back and remember a person afterwards. Because they wouldn't be able to close their eyes and see a person's face, mm-hmm. because they wouldn't recognize what that was to them. So there is something connected between your understanding and theirs. in a way. I don't know how.
Wow. I first of all, I want to say one thing. One is that it's especially funny with Carolyn because you are an artist. And yeah, I think that's why it came up literally, in the first place.
I was so fascinated when I found out you had aphantasia.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're an artist and you but the way you do art is very
very like reference based looking at
exactly.
photos and things like that. Yeah. But that also like my ability to recognize faces. I can see like a face, but like if I've met somebody, I probably have to like meet them a few times to fully know.
So
what
do
their
you
face
actually
looks like.
That's really interesting. But you remember? Yeah. Do you think you remember their faces?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Could you see, if you walked past me or Tom in the street, would you know
oh,
it was us?
Yeah, yeah, I'd know who you two were, totally.
Even if
I definitely don't know.
Our hair was different.
Yes.
Okay, so that is a distinct difference.
Yeah,
someone
yeah,
with
totally.
Personal nose, they couldn't do that. They wouldn't know mm-hmm. who we are, for the most part.
I just want to say quickly, in comparison, Ella, when you were talking about, you know, people possibly having more, like, an overactive pareidolia and aphantasia, in contrast to Carolyn, when I was in grade school, I would sometimes just like look at the carpet and be like, oh, look at all those like images.
And I reckon the chances are you have something in the lines of like, because aphantasia is a spectrum. Like some people with aphantasia will not be able to have any imagery and some will have some level of imagery, right? And on the other end is hyperphantasia, I think it's called, something like that. So maybe you have something over that way, because it sounds like people, from what I've been reading, people who have this more vivid mental imagery experience pareidolia more frequently or can find it more. So I wonder if there is a difference between you and Tom, Caroline. You say, so you to answer my question before, do people with aphantasia experience pareidolia, you're saying from your experience, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But possibly less than other people, yeah.
But potentially, who knows? Well, I mean, there's no, like, subjective way to measure it. Maybe we should do a study. Maybe we'll put that on the the Patreon.
Throw that on a week, yeah. Who needs a Wikipedia when you're in the journal?
I'd love to do a study showing you guys, like, static, because you can get these kind of, like, static images which have faces hidden in them kind of thing, and see mm-hmm. if your difference in perception of whether or not there is a face there was, yeah.
That would be so much fun.
Maybe I'll find some of these and we could do it. We could do some like a raw Rorschach ink block thing.
This could be an early episode of Let's Learn Nothing.
Yeah, we carry out our own scientific study.
Yeah.
we started off doing it with like, we'll do silly episodes. This is like, then we could do some trials.
We could do a trial.
We could do research, yeah.
That's actually the end of the question. I really wanted to know. I was so excited when I got to this end and I found that this study linked into aphantasia and Caroline. I was
that's
like, oh, I
so
can't wait
cool.
to find out if she has... And to be honest, I expected you would say yes, because it's what is very clear to me after doing all this research is that none of it makes sense. Neuroscience is so incredibly complex. Like, and not just it's not just neuroscience in like the terms in the sense of the technical makeup of our brain, but also our own social perception and the way we understand the world is so nuanced that there's just no way to know whether or not someone actually will or won't based on your kind of like, oh, this part of the brain doesn't work, so you must not be able to. Because your brain will find ways around it. Because it needs to.
Yeah. I'm looking back at my simple explanation and cringing so hard.
No, I don't.
And I should know.
No, you're not wrong at all. Because like I asked a few people this and a bunch of them, the first thing, they immediately went no. And I also thought, no, of course not. Like my immediate feeling was no. But then as soon as you take a step in, you think, actually, the complexity, sir.
Yeah, with scrutiny, because, like, with my original explanation, it's like three blocks lined up, right? It's like, do, they connect. But, like, and then you bring into question things like recall and, like, memory. And, like, these things don't happen statically. They happen, and then it's so... I will also say, the one part of me, of course, is tremendously frustrated that the answer is shrug, right? Because it's like, I want to answer. But then the other part of me is so glad that the answer is shrug, because I think that's wonderful and that's beautiful and that speaks to the complexity of the human brain. And it would be a lot weirder if there were these... It would be a lot scarier if it was so simple.
I think. Completely agree.
So
there should almost never be a simple answer for anything that involves your perception of the world, because everyone has such individualistic experiences of that, which is shaped by many, many things in your life, including, but not limited to, your brain structure. So there will never ever be a simple answer anytime we do anything neuroscience related.
I'm also just so glad that's like there are questions out there that science doesn't know the answer to yet. And that's a relief. I like that very much.
Yes, I completely agree. But I will say there are some bits of your brain we do know. If you get rid of that, or it's not working, you're dead.
Yay! If you do get rid of the brain, we do need that. We do know we need the brain.
The reason, the story of Phineas Gage. You know the.
You know what? I am eating my words now, because literally that. Yeah.
For those who don't know, which I'm sure you do if you're listening to the podcast, the man who got the railroad spike through his eye, it took out a big, big chunk of his brain, and what it got rid of, but he was still functional. He was still very, very functional. And I saw that, okay, you might have to cut this or put it somewhere else, but I was reading all about this as part of this, kind of just for fun. And obviously it was reported that his mood changed, he became really aggressive, and that's what changed about him. But actually, apparently, a lot of that might have been overstated, and actually it might not have changed as much as... It seemed that was kind of like sensationalised around the time to show that, he wasn't really okay, kind of thing, but actually he might have just been very...
Well, also, like, could
a bit aggravated
like,
with having a railroad spike through his head.
Just generally frustrated.
Uh-huh. And also the scrutiny of everyone being like, hey, can I see your brain? That would make me...
Well, he became a, a sideshow, basically. So I'm sure he was very frustrated.
You know, I think that anecdotal and specific events like these are very illuminating and can definitely point you in the direction of research, but it's not research because there are so many contextual things going on here that you can't.
Yeah.
Okay, to recap the words, the glossary, we got pareidolia, or pareidolia, which is recognition of objects, typically faces. We have the prosopagnosia, which I did write down. That's the only reason why, which is face blindness.
Yeah.
We have, we have the ability to visualize, which is called apophantasia.
You're so close. Aphantasia.
And then that portion of the brain was the...
If you remember this.
Bibim bib bop bop beep boop.
Brilliant. Nailed it.
Fusiform gyrus or fusiform face area.
Yeah.
The fusiform face area.
Well done. So cool. That was a good recall.
Wild.
This episode, I'm doing the miscellaneous topic, which is it's a story time about the time that I sort of met David Attenborough. I assume both of you know who that man is. I assume most of the people listening know who that man is.
I mean, I do, but I'm British.
Tom, do you know who?
I do, yes.
Okay. For anybody
he's the
who... Go on, yeah.
Person who... it must be really expensive. They bring him out whenever they film wildlife shoots. They bring him to the set, and he has to narrate it all as it happens on the... Oh, I guess he does it in post. That makes more sense.
When he was younger, he used to go to the places and, like, do all the stuff himself.
Oh, actually.
Like, before, you know, you could do this kind of research easily, he would go there and just look at things himself and just have, like, one camera with him. But now he's old. They do all the shooting and he just narrates it.
I said that as a joke. Wow.
Yeah, now he's 95. And
he's 95?
He's
Jeez.
95.
Wow.
He was born cracking on. Was it 1926 or something ridiculous like that? Yeah.
Wow.
So anybody who doesn't know, he's an absolute national treasure here in the UK. Mm-hmm. We love him. He's a household name. He's been knighted. He is Sir David Attenborough. But he's an incredibly famous naturalist, presenter, and writer. He's done things like Blue Planet, Life on Earth. Green Planet is about to come out. Would totally recommend listening to
Blue Planet.
It or watching it. Blue Planet and Blue Planet 2 are just some of my favourite things that have been made.
Of Planet Earth, I think it's Planet Earth, there's a deep sea episode, and I recommend getting high and watching it.
Get high and get deep.
because it's wild. It's like all the weird deep sea creatures just in complete blackness. And then and they add all these weird beeping noises over it, like alien kind of like blue. It's very weird.
So yeah, basically he's a really cool guy that if you're in like the field of conservation or nature in any way, or in biology, you're probably going to look up to him. And I certainly do. So this story is back from my final year of my undergrad. I did my first degree in biology at Keele University. And whilst I was studying there, the university had this brand new shining laboratory being built. This like 11 million pound building. Ooh. Being built. It's great. It's been used for a period of time. It's waiting for finishing touches, being like painted, having the doors put on, you know, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And also deciding officially what the rooms are going to be called, especially what the labs are going to be called, because the labs were quite high tech. Some of them certainly were.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted them to have some nice names, including the Attenborough Lab.
That's nice. And he should have more stuff. Yeah. He should have more stuff named after him.
So if you want to name something like a building or a room or a lab after a living person, you have to ask their permission. Obviously.
Oh. Oh no. Shit. Carolyn, don't you dare take me down this road.
But I named my bedroom the Caroline Roper room. So what am I supposed to do now?
I think we need to establish some boundaries in our friendship, Ella.
The Caroline Roper studio for TikToks of science.
And the kitchen's the Tom Lum room. So I don't know. What am I supposed to do?
If you ever move out and people move in, you're going to be like, and here is
the... Yeah, I've put plaques up.
Please, before you move out, just Sharpie and really small somewhere.
The living room is the Janet space, of course.
Yeah, Janet space.
We love you, Janet.
The Janet space. The Janet center for...
Damn it, Janet.
Love and compassion.
I love you. That was a Rocky Horror Picture Show reference.
Of course it was.
Carolyn.
Very good.
I'm terrified, please.
So the university asks David Attenborough if we can use his name for the lab. And he says yes.
They didn't murder... Okay. Are you thinking they didn't murder him so he was dead? No. And they didn't have to ask?
Ella, I did not think that, but that is quite a book.
That's so much. Oh my god.
That is quite a plot. I love that premise. So you're saying that
mean you're planning on murdering us so that you can keep the names of your house?
Well, if you don't give me permission...
We need permission so long as they're alive. Wait, what was that last part? So long as they're alive?
I thought that's what you were reacting to, Tom.
No. My thought was that he would show up and be like, hey, is that my name? Okay, you scared me.
So he says yes on the condition... Great. That he can come to the university and meet the students who are going to be using the lab.
Win-win. You have to pretend like that's a like you're losing on that deal, but that's a win-win.
Literally, like the university was like, hell yeah, free press. Students are going to want to come here. Obviously, we're going to say yes to this. So the university sets up like a day for Sir David Attenborough. There's going to be three events. There's going to be the opening ceremony for the building itself.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to have like a tour of the labs. And then he's going to go and give a talk to a bunch of the students. And the university decides that for the first two events, so for the opening and for the tour of the labs, there should be students involved so that he can actually go up and talk to them. So there are going to be students at the opening ceremony handing him bits of paperwork and stuff like that. And then there'll be students actually doing little lab practicals so that he can come and have a look at what we're doing, have a little wander around.
I was really hoping he would just narrate college life. And be like, here we see... The young male playing acoustic guitar, attempting to attract the females unsuccessfully.
I'd pay good money for this to happen, not gonna lie. So the third event, the big talk, is open to any student on campus. But the first two are just open to people in the School of Life Sciences, which was my school. It was great.
Yay!
I got priority. It was lovely. So the thing was going to be like, students could put their name forwards. They basically pick the names out of a hat. Limited number of spaces, so limited number of people can go. There's like hundreds of students in the School of Life Sciences. So I'm just like,
oh, wow.
It would be dumb of me not to put my name forward. Mm. So you do that, and then you basically forget that it's even happening, because you're just like, you're not going to get in.
Totally,
it's fine.
Totally.
Just put your name down and see what happens. So fast forward literally to like the end of my academic experience.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Really, really exciting week for me. I had just found out that my my final year research project was going to get published in a student journal.
Woo!
I was going to be presenting it. So I was like, this is the highlight of my university experience. This is like the coolest thing ever for me. I was so excited about it. My housemate, who did a very similar course to me, he'd gotten an email saying that he hadn't got in to the David Attenborough thing at all. So I was just like, it's fine. It's fine. Like, I know that that's going to be the answer. I'm just going to really enjoy what's happening right now. You know, this is really, really cool. And then in the same week, I get an email saying that I'm going to be doing the lab practicals.
Yay!
Which is very, very
wild.
Cool. And then obviously the journal didn't matter anymore because I was going to be in the same room as David Attenborough.
What was the practical?
I will tell you all about it in a second because
it was
something.
terrified.
So the university's taking this very, very seriously. We have like a big meeting with every single student who's going to be there, basically saying like, if you fuck this up for us, you're not going to have a degree at the end of it. Like,
no.
Like really, really dead serious. Like, you need to be on your fucking behavior today. Do not make us look bad. Because it's David Attenborough. Like, if you're fucking around in front of that man...
I like to get high and watch the deep sea episode of Blue Planet.
I would absolutely attempt to say that to him.
Honestly, when he's in the... You don't know what to say. I'll get to my response. So, yeah, they do the health and safety talk with us and everything. They say, don't fuck it up. Okay, go into the labs and we'll tell you about your practicals. So we've been split onto, like, four long lab benches. And it's, like, course specific. So we've got the neuroscientists at one end who are doing something with their brains. They're, like, sticking electrodes onto their heads and stuff like that. Like, they look like they're doing something serious. There's, like, the biochemists who have a bunch of equipment out. They also look like they know what they're doing. You know, they look really cool.
Sciencey, very sciencey.
And then there's us, the biologists, who... So, like, the practicals had to be quite simple because it was a range of, like, first to third years doing these practicals. So it's like, okay, we're going to pick something really simple for you guys, don't worry. So what they pick for us is a practical that I had done in my first year, which was basically you get a bunch of these teeny tiny beetles... And you put them into a container and you watch their behavior. You're looking to see if they mate with each other or if they fight each other.
Okay.
So we were doing a practical basically, and somebody had to explain to Sir David Attenborough that we were looking to see if these beetles would fight or fuck. You know?
Makes sense.
What we're doing. Somebody has to explain this to this man. I don't want it to be me.
I mean, he talks about animals fucking all the time.
Yeah.
So
he does. But when you're the one explaining it to him, tiny little, like, 18 to 21-year-old, who's like, hi, yeah, we're looking at these teeny tiny beetles mating. I can barely see them. I hope you can. Enjoy. So, yeah, that was going to be our experiment. So he comes in to the building. Everybody's, like, very, very excited. He walks into the room. And everybody, again, is very, very excited. Everybody is, like, trying to act as normal as they can. But also, like... A bunch of people's idol has just walked into the room and it's like, oh my God, what's happening?
Into the room named after him.
Yeah. So he is like, just putting this out there, David Attenborough is the nicest person. He tried to interact with every single person in that room. And there were maybe like 60 people in there, like all trying to just be like, oh my God, talk to me, hi. He is shaking people's hands. So he comes over and like... He's like, hello, and all I can do is just wide-eyed smile and be like, hi, and then he walks away. And that's my entire interaction with this man. But it was still, like, super cool.
Did he say hi back?
He did say hello, and it was, I think he shook my hand, I can't entirely remember. It's all a bit of a blur, because it was insane. But he, like... He goes round and he says hello to everybody. I learn afterwards that actually the neuroscientists probably had the worst experiment out of all of us. Because they're like, again, they're meeting their idol with freaking electrodes and bits of wire stuck to their faces.
Great point. That is a great point.
not ideal, but, you know, we persevere. He does, like, a Q&A with us. He's like, I really want to chat to you guys. We hadn't prepared questions beforehand, but he was still really, like, happy to listen to us, and he gave really, really insightful answers and things like that. Like, he seemed like he genuinely wanted to be in that room with us, and it was really, really cool. Mm,
that's really nice. It's nice to hear he's down to earth.
Yeah.
He is. He was really, really
down
sweet.
Down to this green planet.
Gosh. But, like, there's a moment where he's, like, he's saying goodbye, and we're all like, bye, and he's just like, oh, come on, give me a cheer, and he waves his arms up into the air, and everybody just goes, hey, like that. Oh. And, and I do have a photo of that moment.
That's what they do. They just go, hey.
Hey.
What's going on?
Woo. So then he leaves. The end of, oh, he sticks around. He does, like, a BBC interview with Oslo in the background. So that's kind of cool,
You just staring at beetles.
Just like, in the background.
That is a roller coaster, true roller coaster of a story. I'm glad both you and Sir David Attenborough ended up all right.
Everybody was fine. No, I don't think any beetles did fuck that day. Very disappointing.
Oh, okay, so that was going to be my last question, was whether they...
The Beatles were not playing ball for David Attenborough. No.
All right. So does anyone have any plugs or shout outs? I want to start real quick with a little review that we got from Marquis de Favre on Apple Podcasts. The subject is Love Letter to Learning. And they go, this show is fascinating. If you're the kind of person who reads show notes and clicks on the links or looks up articles about things mentioned in the news or tells coworkers about a cool fact you just heard, LLE is for you. There is so much reinforcement of good scientific principles throughout the show, from questioning the foundation of assertions and avoiding absolutes to investigating biases and encouraging feedback. There is so much in the universe that can be learned in a single lifetime, but these mini lessons from Carolyn, Ella, and Tom are a delightful way to expand your brain and nurture your learner's spirit.
Oh my goodness, wow. Who did you say did that?
A person with the username Marquis de Favre.
Marquis de Favre, thank you so much. That as a quote on the website, Tom. Mm-hmm. That's so good.
I love that.
But thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you all for leaving reviews. It truly, yeah. There are so many, and
they get read.
Oh, they all do.
They all make me.
All of them make us happy.
Truly, all of them.
Every single
one. That was so nice.
I'm going to shout out, I mean, I'm whoever I am, Ella Hubber on Twitter and Big Science Energy on TikTok, and none of your business anywhere else. and I'm going to shout out the Patreon once more if you want to support us, if you want our extra content. And you can find our Patreon where, Tom?
You can find the link to our Patreon and all of our socials at letslearneverythingpod.com.
Oh, you're new. Oh, Caroline's new.
I will shout myself out because I've changed a bunch of my usernames in the new year. So I am now Caroline the Bug on TikTok, Twitter, and on Instagram. And none of your business anywhere else.
I'm Tom Lumperson, all places. Did get a new profile picture, so you gotta see if you can recognize me still. Anyway, this has been a delightful episode to start the year off. I'm really excited.
It's been so fun.
Very good.
All right, so today we learned about the wild and strange and beautiful history of recorded audio. We learned about, give me a second, we learned...
Oh, you're not going
to get
it.
We didn't get the full answer, but we sure did learn a lot about prosopagnosia.
Oh, you're very... Well done.
I wrote that down.
Oh,
and then pareidolia. And Woo! Also, more importantly, about how complicated the brain is. But also so interesting. And then lastly, we learned about the wonderful time that Carolyn met Sir David Attenborough and what it's like to meet celebrities like that. And you can join us all next time as we learn about
everything.
Let's Learn Everything is independently produced and hosted by Ella Hubber, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper. Editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum. Lovely. Well done, guys. Charlie just stuck his head through the ring light and it was so fucking cute. I was like barely holding it together. It was so cute. Oh, baby.
Oh, good grief.